FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Today's show is brought to you by U.S. Gold Corp. U.S. Gold Corp. is a U.S.-focused gold exploration and development company advancing high-potential projects in Wyoming and Nevada. U.S. Gold Corp. has consolidated a district on Nevada's productive Cortex Trend and is advancing the Copper King project towards production in Wyoming. Led by a team of prolific company builders and renowned explorers, including Dave Mathewson, who is directly responsible for several major Nevada gold discoveries, U.S. Gold Corp. is well-capitalized and has an extremely tight share structure with less than 20 million shares outstanding and trades on the NASDAQ, a major exchange, under the ticker symbol USAU. To learn more, go to usgoldcorp.gold. That's usgoldcorp.gold.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 5/23/19. Well, hey, as always, much going on in the world. One thing we haven't covered much, and it was remiss on my part, was the recent election in Australia. And it was really a referendum on climate change, not so much on whether or not it's happening, but that perhaps the cure could be worse than the disease. I mean, look, it would be really difficult to build a train to Australia. So getting rid of air travel just isn't really an option. Otherwise, Australia would be completely isolated except for ships coming in and out. And ships also put out the dreaded carbon. So what is a society to do? In Australia, they did what I believe the right thing, and they just said, no, we're not going to sacrifice the economy for or in support of a theory which has many, many holes in it, at least not until there's definitive proof, which clearly there hasn't been. Well, got somebody on with us, hasn't been on in years, literally, but we're happy to say now, Bron Suchecki, and he's still in the bullion business. Hey, as always, questions, comments, etc., email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. So, Bron, it's great to have you back on. It's been a while, but the world's been moving on, so we appreciate you coming on. So first, let's talk about this crazy election that shocked all of the experts. You know, you always wonder, who are these experts and why are they always surprised? You know, because that's usually, you usually see experts surprised. Those two terms always one with the other.
Yes, it's great to be back on the show, Kerry, and thanks for having me on. Yeah, so look, it was a surprise result, according to the experts. I mean, just to put it, I suppose, in terms for your listeners, and I'll refer to our political parties as Republican Democrats, even though they have different names, but let's make it probably easier to refer them to them that way. So we had our Republicans were in power and the election was put on place, and the Democrats were on a platform. I'd say very simplistically, it was a tax and spend platform. So they wanted to raise taxes on certain issues like capital gains tax. They were tweaking that. They were going to change taxes on property, looking to change taxes on dividends, which would have affected retirees, self-funded retirees. And then they were looking to spend that money on climate change and other sorts of issues. So it was a bit strategic in that the taxing part of it was really taxing voters who weren't really going to be voting for the Democratic type party. And then they were spending it on things that their classic sort of Democratic voter would like. So it was pretty sort of divisive in that sense, I suppose. And in any case, the media, and to be honest, I mean, look, the media here, as most countries, is a bit left-leaning. But having said that, the polls were all in showing that the Democratic version of, in Australia was going to win, but they were proven completely wrong, and the Republicans have managed to get back in. And one of the big factors, as you pointed out, was climate change. That was a very high profile part of the platform for the Democratic Party here. And they actually, it's probably considered that the northern part of Australia, Queensland, where there's, it is a resource-driven part of the country. And there was also a very contentious new coal mine that was being slated for implementation. And there was a lot of negativity about that on one side of politics. But that state actually swung very heavily against the Democratic Party towards the Republican version, and that actually probably is what lost the election for the Democratic side. So it certainly was a turnaround. It was very much a case of, I think, the silent Australian, the conservative or middle-of-the-road Australian that is you know, everyone is concerned about environmental issues and pollution and that sort of thing. But, you know, you need to have a job. You need to be able to put food on the table. And, you know, closing down or not allowing a new mine to come on stream, which was going to employ people, was a big factor for that part of the country. And it sort of flowed through to the rest of the other electorates. So it was a bit of a shock for the pundits. But, yes, they managed to eke a win out.
Yeah. Yeah, surprisingly so. But maybe not so surprisingly. I think probably you're having the same phenomena in Australia that we have here in the US, and that is people either lying outright to the pollsters or refusing to participate in the whole process of polling, right?
Yeah, I think there was two factors. I mean, certainly I think it's a case where people probably aren't really truthful when they are polled, and probably because, you know, if they're voting for what appears to be sort of demonized candidates, then they sort of feel embarrassed about saying that, or there's this public perception that, you know, and there were some sort of more rightward leaning independent type candidates and smaller parties. And so I think people were like, well, I'm not going to tell this person that I'm voting for them, you know, because, you know, that doesn't seem right. So there's that, certainly that element. But the other thing is interesting as well is that some election analysts were saying that the problem, and this is an issue that has been getting more important over the last few years, is that as people move away from landline phones towards cell phones, that in the past, the pollsters would look at the electoral roll and do a full random sample, statistically correct random sample, and phone homes up. And so they knew that they were getting a representative view of the electorate. But now with all the mobile phones, they're more randomly sort of calling mobile phones and trying to, you know, to get a result. And it's resulting in that lack of true statistical randomness. And so that was the other factor, I think, that's coming into place. But that means that all polls going forward are going to be somewhat biased.
Yeah, so exactly. I think it's obvious that the old methods don't work. I think there's problems, though, when they try to do online polls because you don't know who your sample is. You don't know how you got to them. And, yeah, I know everybody's email address is in a database and they probably can pick party affiliation. But in Australia, do you have these traditional that went for your version of the Democrats, working class people who've now switched to your version of the Republicans because they see that that these policies directly threaten their livelihood?
Yeah, certainly. I think that's a factor because I think the thing in this case was that there's the aspirational aspect of the working class and middle class is that and Australians are very much this fair go is a very much a strong part of how Australians see themselves. So I think people probably resented or reacted negatively towards a sort of political platform, which was, you know, we're going to change the tax things against self-funded retirees and against people who have got investment properties. You know, they were changing the way those things were treated from a tax point of view. And, you know, and I think the average person, even if they maybe were still young or couldn't afford an investment property, they maybe still had aspirations that maybe they could, you know, if they could pay off their house or they had a bit of extra money, maybe they would look to buy a property for investment. And so they could see the way that those tax changes were structured, that that was really biased against that. So I think there is an element where, in a sense, the Democratic Party, I've seen this criticism in some of the media, is that they have skewed a little bit more too much towards the, you know, the green sort of agenda and have moved away from their working class roots. And certainly in the 90s, the Democratic or Labor Party in Australia did have a very much a reform sort of agenda around the economy. They opened up the Australian economy, floated the exchange rate. There was a sort of an accord between the unions and business to sort of control wages, but you know, make sure that the wage growth was there. So it was a very different sort of Democratic Party, and it was a lot more appealing to aspirational aspects. So, and I think I've seen this criticism. So I think in Australia, what's happened is you get a bit more divisiveness and sort of splitting of the electorate and the community to sort of one camp or the other. And I've seen this criticism or observation made in the US, where if you look at there's a decreasing sort of center position between Democrats and Republicans, and it's widening the gap in terms of a sort of them and us. And you know, I think it's a general trend across a lot of economies, countries, where you know, you can win your side of your voter over by becoming more right or more left-ish. And that solidifies your base. But what's happening is that the centrist position, the middle of the ground, is becomes sort of smaller and smaller. So I don't think that's very good for a democracy. You want to have, you know, a middle of the road sort of majority, I suppose, that you can have a sort of balanced policies rather than one or the other. You know, one party gets in, they switch all the policies the other guys had, and then they switch them back when they win back again. You know, that's not really good for stability.
Yeah, definitely not. And it's like the ultimate in polarization. And it seems to be a trend that's happening all over the world.
Yeah.
So until something breaks and something will change, you know, you have these battles, and then there's a paradigm shift and everybody forgets that the battle even took place. And my guess is that's going to be what happens here as well, but I'm not going to speculate about the outcome. But bullion, you know, since we started talking, you know, gold has kind of been in a bear market, not kind of, it has, for the past 8 years, and doesn't show a lot of signs of breaking out of that bear. What's your take on it?
Look, I think it certainly has been in a bear, although if you look back now, it is in a start of a bull market. I mean, it has bottomed. It bottomed at that sort of where it really got scary there and got down to $1,000 and started to look like it was going to get below $1,000. But from that point, it has ground its way up so that we have seen it on its way, trying to get to 1,400. You know, it's sort of getting down to 13, but it has moved up. Now, the way that I look at it is there are a lot of people that got into the price run, and I think there are a lot of new investors, more mainstream investors, that got in as the gold price, you know, peaked into 2011. And then as the price came off, I certainly saw a lot of clients sort of bailing out, let's say. And what I think's happened is as the price has been moving up from $1,000 now and up to 13 and over the last few years, what's happened is I did see a lot of clients on every price move up, so up to 1,100, up to 1,200, up to 1,300, you would see selling by clients. And they were sort of like the old clients that had been in. They were waiting for, you know, for this $2,000 for it to get back, and it wasn't happening. And they're like, okay, well, that's it. I'm out. I'm done. You know, and so during this sort of grind up, you've had those sort of stale longs, those sort of disaffected holders bailing out. So that's what sort of my mind has sort of capped the price a little bit on its way up. You know, you've seen those corrections over the last few years, but it has been moving up in a general trend. I think we're out of that now. I think anyone who's ran out of faith is out of the metals. And I don't think we're going to see any more selling by sort of people that have had enough. So I think that's finished. But to get gold to make the next move up into 1400 and beyond, you need to get new money in. So we certainly have got a lot of existing holders who are like, I'm with gold, I'm going to stay with it. It's an insurance policy. It goes up, it goes down, but you know, they're not so fussed about price. Those people are in, they're rusted in, they're sitting there, they're happy with gold as that insurance part of their portfolio. But to get the price to really move, we need new money. But to get new money, you need a story. You know, there needs to be a reason. The media need to cover it. And I think that's the issue for gold at the moment, is that there isn't a story behind gold. You know, there isn't a reason, a compelling reason for the average person who's not that focused on precious metals for them to buy into it. Now, I do think that on the professional markets and the serious investors, we're starting to see the buying, and this is what happens. You know, the smart money comes in early, and then the retail mass market follows. But I think we're seeing the smart money come in, but that's enough to support it, and we see the support coming in at certain price levels. As I said, right now, as it gets below 1300, but you know, 1250 is a base, or 1260. So I think that the smart money's in, it's accumulating. Certainly the central banks, a few choice central banks like China and Russia are accumulating as well. So I think that's the support. It's enough to give gold a base. But I think once we start to see a little bit more negativity on some of the economic factors, and there's still the debt issue, all these issues are still in play. You know, these issues we talked about years ago from 2008 crisis, they're all still there. They haven't been dealt with. But, you know, the can kicking has been very effective, but there's a limitation to that. I've been surprised at how long they've been able to kick the can.
Yes, I mean, we all are.
But, you know, the average person wants to believe that the central bankers can, you know, the government, don't worry, they'll fix it all up.
Yeah.
And so I think in precious metals, and for people who think outside the box and are a little bit more critical, they see these problems. But for the average person in the street, you know, they are more trusting of government and of the bureaucrats, and they like to think that, you know, that things are under control. And it's a little bit scary. I mean, if you put yourself into the position of an average person who's maybe not across all these issues that, you know, that you educate your listeners on, you know, it's a bit scary to think, wait a minute, what, no one's in control? You know,
who
this idea that the central bankers, you know, can pull this lever and press that button and jigger around with this interest rate, and don't worry, that'll be that, you know, they've got it under control. I mean, that's comforting, but let's be realistic. I mean, that's not really, we don't run centralized planned economies, simply don't work. But for some reason, as crazy as it seems, that you can just change an interest rate and that will magically fix whatever economic problems there are. But, you know, that seems to be the consensus.
Yeah.
But I think that's not a sustainable solution. But for the moment, until that, you know, curtain comes around from that man in the emerald tower in the Wizard of Oz and is revealed for what it is, then we will find that it will still continue to grind along, but I'm not sure how long that can continue from this point.
Yeah, good question, and for which I have to confess I don't have an answer. I wish I did, but it's one of those things. The trend is your friend until the end, right?
Yeah, Well, yes, we don't know, because what we're talking about here is confidence. We're talking about the average person's confidence in the governments and central bankers and others to keep the economy ticking over. And confidence is it's a subjective thing. It's not something that, you know, we can get our analytical things out and make, you know, a hard assessment of. Although technical analysis of charts, that's what it tries to do, is to sense sentiment and emotional factors in the markets. But we're talking here about the average person and their view and confidence in the government. And I can say, I mean, after the financial crisis, Kerry, what I did see in buying, it was a really clear pattern that particularly from the financial crisis, if you remember, there was always it's almost like every day you come in and there'd be some new headline of some disaster happening, you know, Bear Stearns, yes, this, that. So what we saw, I saw, was that every time there was a new shock or a new piece of news, that there'd be a surge in gold buying, a surge in new accounts opening. And then it would stabilize, it would flatten out a little bit, you know. And then there'd be some other bit of news happening, some other, you know, central banks have to do some new thing to save some other new problem, because there was lots of little mini problems all the way from that financial crisis onwards.
A lot of holes in the dikes.
Yeah, and so there were a lot of things, and you can forget about it now, but at the time, even over the years following the financial crisis, there were still things happening. There were new programs that the central bank had to put in place to get liquidity back into the financial markets, all of that sort of stuff. So on every one of those headlines, we saw surges in buying, then it would flatten out. Then there'd be another surge on the next bit of news. And my way of looking at that was that what I think was happening is that everyone has a different level of trust in the system, or a different level of freak-outedness, right? So the really, really, really trusting people, they need a lot of bad things to happen before they pop their head up and go, what the hell's going on here? You know, how do I protect myself? Other people that are a lot more sensitive to it, they probably freak out a lot earlier. You know, so they were the earlier buyers of gold. And as the crisis deepened, you saw more and more people questioning and saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? How do I protect myself? And then they'd look at gold, and that's where you'd see the surge. So I think in this final sort of phase as we're going through currently, we'll see that same dynamic happen. But people, I think the central bankers have been able to paper over things, so people have sort of become a bit complacent. But as things unravel, we will see that same dynamic come in place, where people will start to say, in different clumps, people will start to get a realization that things haven't been fixed and there's still underlying problems. And then that will see surges, temporary surges, coming into precious metals.
And who knows with Deutsche Bank, they're very tenuous. They're walking a tightrope, as it were. And you just don't know what's going to be with that bank. My gut feel is, in the end, the German government is going to bail it out in one form or another, because nobody, and it's still the same, nobody wants to be known as the person who allowed the entire global financial system to unravel.
Yes. Right?
I mean, doesn't it come down to that? Like, in the end, these politicians do care. They think about how history is going to see their reign. And maybe ordinary people like you and I couldn't care less about history. You know, we're not historical figures or major ones, certainly, to speak of. These politicians really do view life that way.
Yes, no, they do. And it's hard to know what will trigger. I mean, look, I think for people that look at it critically, there is no doubt that there are still underlying problems. You know, if you look across lots of different economic sort of measures, wage growth, underemployment, a sort of pseudo, you know, people are working but not working the amount of hours they want to work. You look at a lot of measures like that. The economy is not, you know, doing great. So there's been this sort of stagnation. It's like we're going through what Japan went through. So I think that we haven't boomed back. You know, it's not like what was done after the financial crisis has fixed things to the point that everything's back on track and, you know, everything's really back to normal. We're in a bit of a stagnation phase, and it has been for the last 10 years. And the problem with that is that it means that the overall economy and the system is still fragile. And there's something like a Deutsche Bank, it could be any other sort of events enough to trigger it. We don't know what would trigger it off. But you're right, they will still keep attempting to buy assets and fiddle with this and adjust that to try and avoid that sort of reality. And I mean, in some sense, the worst case scenario could be just continuing to muddle along in this sort of stagnant, not really doing great, but not really doing bad. Mm-hmm. And we have a sort of Japanification where everything's just sort of stagnant for a really long time. And we're stuck at a really low growth.
Yeah. It's very possible, isn't it? It could just continue on that way.
It's possible, but I think the longer that happens, the more susceptible, the weaker you are. Like, it's like if, you know, you're physically weak, you're not healthy, you're not eating right, you're not exercising, then you're more susceptible to catch a cold or to get an infection compared to someone who's a lot more fit and active and healthy. So I think from an economy point of view, it's not the best analogy, but, you know, if the economy's weak and it's not strong and there's people that would like to work that aren't working, there's, you know, those things don't make the economy robust enough against another shock if that happens. And certainly, I mean, look, you know, this trade war with China is just, I think, a manifestation of this malignancy or, you know, sort of stagnation that we're seeing, that you're now starting to see, you know, America's trying to look after its interests, China's trying to look after its, and you're butting up against heads. And again, these things can, I mean, those sorts of events are like catching a cold or getting a sniffle, and it might turn into pneumonia or, you know, something more serious. So I think we're fragile. We're more fragile than we used to be.
Yeah, I think you're right. Hey, so Ron, just tell us about the company you're with now, what you're doing these days.
Yeah, so Paleon is an Australian sort of entity that covers across refining, bullion bars and coins, and vaulting, but it also is an Australian success in manufacturing jewelry. So, you know, you probably the same as you've seen in the US. In Australia, we have the same issue where a lot of manufacturing goes offshore. Paleon has a huge manufacturing, jewelry manufacturing business in Australia, employs a lot of people. I've been down to their offices, and it's just amazing to look at these CAD machines where the designers are designing these rings, you know, in 3D, and then they're printed on a wax on a 3D printer, and then they use the wax that's printed straight off the computer model. Is then used in the lost wax casting process to cast the actual piece of jewelry. So it's really fascinating, and that technology's changed jewelry quite a lot. Where you can now, jewelers can now design pieces that are physically impossible to make using traditional jewelry techniques, but because of the CAD CAM and the 3D printing, you can create these really intricate pieces of jewelry. So it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, that really is. And yeah, there's so much that you don't even think of, like technology affecting the jewelry business, because you think of these craftsmen slaving away at their desks, right, or at their tables with a hand, you know, with chiseling away the metal, kind of carving it away. But nothing could be further from the truth now.
No, well, actually, I mean, I've obviously been very, I mean, I'm more of an expert on the bullion side, so the jewelry's a bit newer to me, but I was talking to the jewelry guys out of our Perth office where I work, and they said there's some element in the jewelry, in traditional jewelers, that sort of look down upon or resent this sort of CAD CAM type approach. where they're sort of, you know, like, hey, what happens to the artistic, you know, the skill of getting that little bit of gold and melting it and, you know, making that piece by hand? But then I think there's an element where you've got the younger generation and one of the ladies in the office there, you know, just came out of the technical college. I heard her talking to the other guy like, oh, what CAD CAM program do you use? You know, it's like that's the, they're au fait with the technology, with the computer. It's natural to them to design a ring, you know, on a computer and then have it 3D printed and then cast into gold. Now, you still need the skill to set the diamond and to polish it up and all of that sort of thing. So it's just a different way of working. And also it allows, there's still a role for that artisan sort of jeweler. But I think it also allows someone to, you know, if they come up with a great design, then they can get, you know, once they've done the 3D wax model and they've got the cast ready, they can cast it multiple times. So for a young jeweler who's got a great eye for a design and who would have maybe only been able to make one-off pieces, it's a lot easier for them now to design a jewelry range and to get multiple pieces made and, you know, to maybe be a success from that sort of point. So there's positives and negatives of this new technology.
Yeah, but it really kind of democratizes the jewelry business. It used to be these hand-designed and hand-made wonders, and they really are. Some of this jewelry is so intricate, and it is so just amazing. You watch it on TV and things, and you look at like the Art Deco-type jewelry, and now they could just bang one of them out in a matter of a couple of days. So it enables people who wouldn't otherwise have access to that level and that quality of jewelry to get all sorts of designs that were out of their reach just a few years ago, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So yeah, it's look, you know, I suppose this is just change. It's and there'll always be a role for a real custom pieces of jewelry to be made that are one-offs. But I think also it does allow for great design to become cheaper and for the average person to be able to access really great designs and get uniqueness like that. So, yeah, and I mean, I think there is sometimes you can print directly in 3D on metal, but it's only certain sort of metals. So I don't think you can do it for gold yet. Maybe the technology will get to the point where even casting, traditional casting, lost wax sort of method of casting falls away, and maybe one day you'll be able to 3D print gold directly. But for the moment, at least the traditional part of having the wax and creating the mold and then casting it, that still exists.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And yeah, it's just like with other technology items that wouldn't be possible without this. Or for instance, you have a 1957 Cadillac Coupe de Ville, and it's got a busted taillight, and you can find that original taillight for probably $500 to $1,000 on the internet, or you can 3D print it for a matter of about $100 or $150, and you know what? You can't even tell the difference, Braun. That technology, I find it really exciting. I mean, there are a lot of people, let's face it, who will not will only use original parts in a car, but there's a lot of people who say, you know what, you can't even tell the difference. It doesn't look like a knockoff. It looks exactly like the other lights. Go for it. So I guess that's the way it is going to be here, right? So
and I think as I get older, I think I also have got to be careful. I think we all have to be careful as we get older to not forget that the youth have a different look at things and they're a lot more optimistic and a lot more positive, notwithstanding how bad everything may be. You know, the advantage of being young is that you're a lot more optimistic and open to new things and change. And that's just the order of things. That's what young people do, and old people's jobs is to act conservatively and, you know, tut, tut, tut. But it's a balance. It's a balance. I mean, that's why you have wise elders in societies and you have the youth that helps balance out. If everyone was young, it'll be crazy and you know, things would probably it helps to have, you know, both sides of the story, I suppose. Absolutely. To have the wise people to moderate the over enthusiasm of the youth, but you want the youth to be able to change and make progress. So
yeah,
it's just human society and nature.
And then old guys like you and me try to stay young and try to stay ahead of all this, or at least keep up with it. Not easy to do. And you need to really, like you say, keep up with it and adopt a kind of more younger frame of mind, if you will, and really just try not to become irrelevant and dated and an antique, right?
Yeah, look, it is, as I say, it's in the mind. You can be old or young in the mind. And I certainly don't feel, I think we all still feel like we were when we were 20 mentally. You know, we don't see ourselves, but you can fall into the trap of becoming a bit of a, dour sort of older person. And you're right. I think it's about a mind frame to look at things that are happening and have a bit of a positive attitude towards it. So it's funny because I'm in the bullion business, and bullion tends to be, because it's an insurance type asset, you know, it's a safety thing. It obviously can tend towards a bit of a doom and gloom. And I sort of don't really like that, because I think that categorization of, buying precious metals doesn't make it appeal to the mainstream, because the mainstream sees that as going, oh, that's the doom and gloom, bullion people. And I think that, to me, I perceive precious metals as just the insurance part of it.
Same.
Something bad happens in the economy, then gold will sort of retain the value. People will move towards it as a way to protect themselves.
Sure. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you have to have a huge doom and gloom view of everything. It's just the insurance there in the portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ron, it's really great reconnecting with you all this time. We'll definitely not let that much time go by again when we speak with you. Hey, just tell us where we find you, website, ways to connect with you.
Look, the easiest way is just to go to abcbullion.com. I report every week on the markets and what's happening, and then you can just follow me at Bron Sucecki on Twitter as well. I do a lot of tweeting on what's going on in the markets.
All right, well, that's always a good thing. Can't get enough tweeting these days. Bron, it's been a pleasure, and thanks so much for staying late for us. We know it's late in Australia. I think you're 12 hours ahead of us, if I'm not mistaken. So it's getting close to midnight on your end, but we will definitely talk to you again. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.